Thanks a lot for your time, Professor, today.
Thank you for having me.
Now, deaths from terrorism in Africa, as we have seen, have skyrocketed more than 100,000% during the so-called U.S. war on terror, according to the new study by the Africa Center for Strategic Studies. Now, these findings contradict claims by the U.S. military command in Africa, known as AFRICOM, that it is thwarting terrorist attacks across the continent. Let's start off with Mr. Ahmad. What's your take on this report?
We can see already that counterinsurgency strategies by especially the West has not improved the life of people. Again, most of the times there are talks about sharing intelligence, supplying African countries with arms to fight insurgency. But again, if this there's a spike in insurgency, clearly shows that the strategies that have been employed are not working. And therefore, there is need to rejig the system. There is need to have alternative arrangements for, to mitigate insurgency on the continent. So again, it is clear that in spite of, the claims to funding, the claims to supply of arms, the claims to sharing of intelligence, there is a gross failure of security architecture, or on the continent.
The U.S. has 21 publicly known military facilities in 15 countries in Africa and a military footprint in most African countries. Now, let's bring in Professor Abdulhab Sheikh. Now, in your opinion, what exactly are U.S. forces doing in Africa? Because we know that they're in the continent under the pretext of fighting terrorism, but we have seen a rapid increase in terrorist attacks across the continent over the last two decades.
U.S. involvement in Africa leads to more terrorism and showing that the current approach is not effective at all. In America or U.S. has more than 21 bases in Africa. Whenever they have a base, the insecurity, the terrorism, the conflict, all, it became, ungovernable. For instance, if I give you an example, for instance, in Somalia, there is Al-Shabaab terrorist organization in Somalia. Who keeping them? Mostly the Western imperialists, because they don't want to allow them, to rule or govern the entire country. At the same time, they want also the government of the day, to at least govern the entire country, because they don't want it. They want to keep, terrorism in Africa so that at least, they can contain within Somali territories. That's why for the last 33 years, Somalia has no effective government. Somalia has no central government. Mainly, the Western world, the imperialist West, they don't want to see, a stable, a strong, and united Somalia.
Areas affected by terrorism in Africa are strategically located and rich in natural resources. From gold and uranium-rich regions of the Sahel to Somalia, a country in a strategic location, to gas-rich Mozambique, a country that experts say has the potential to become the Qatar of Africa. We also have the DRC, the world's largest producer of cobalt and third largest producer of copper. Both minerals are critical for clean energy technologies.
Recently, there have been anti-U.S. demonstrations in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where protesters accuse the U.S. and France of backing rebels and terrorists in the mineral-rich eastern part of the country.
We're claiming our rights. France and the United States are fostering the war in the eastern DRC by supporting the rebellion. A country like Rwanda cannot fight against the Democratic Republic of the Congo. We are marching. We are not breaking or destroying people's property. But the head of the police is sending his officers to chase us away.
There is no doubt that Western powers are out to plunder these resources and therefore cannot be part of the solution. The United States Military Command in Africa, AFRICOM, is now seen by many as an imperialist war machine that creates threats before managing the perception of safety. The ultimate objective of AFRICOM is advancing the United States' economic and geostrategic interest in Africa.
Now, my next question is to Professor Abdulhab Sheikh. Do you think Western imperialist powers are behind the upsurge of terrorism in Africa? And can they really assist in restoring security across the continent?
You know, the BRID, Western BRID list as a part and parcel of African problems as we speak right now. They want to exploit African resources. They want to undermine the safety and security of African continent so that at least they can exploit and loot the African, you know, resources. A very good example in West Africa, whereby, you know, several countries in West Africa, that is Mali, Burkina Faso, Guinea, and Niger, are struggling to contain the terrorism in their respective countries, mainly who are supporting them, those, you know, terrorist groups in West Africa, are Western imperialists. Why are they doing that? In order to loot and exploit African resources. A very good example in Niger, whereby the French companies are mining so that, you know, a 1 kilogram of uranium in Niger, they are buying from locals less than a dollar, and they're going to sell, you know, into the world market more than $240. Right now, as we speak right now, 186 companies are mining in DRC, you know, Democratic Republic of Congo, and they're creating 110 militias which are answerable to the, you know, Western companies, so that they continue the looting, they will continue exploitation, they will continue undermining the safety and security of African societies or African countries, so that they can easily, you know, loot the resources of Africa. But no question about that. I have no doubt in my mind, African, you know, the Western imperialists are part and parcel of African problems today.
The UN Secretary General says efforts to counter terrorism must be anchored in human rights and strategies that focus on the marginalized and vulnerable people.
Communities and the state need to be joined with the common purpose of rejecting terrorist ideologies and challenging those who espouse them. And this means governments adopting a comprehensive and inclusive approach involving all parts of society. It means starting at the grassroots, where families and local communities are at the front line of efforts to protect vulnerable people from succumbing to pernicious ideologies. It means increasing our support to civil society organizations who make a unique and invaluable contribution to tackling terrorism and preventing violent extremism. And I am pleased that many of them will join us tomorrow. And it means engaging women and young people so that they can play meaningful roles in the developing, monitoring and implementing counterterrorism policies and programs.
Now, Mr. Ahmed, can you tell us more on how marginalized persons susceptible to being recruited into terrorist groups can be rescued from these evil terrorist organizations?
So basically, apart from poverty and ignorance, there is need to intentionally bridge the gap between the haves and the have-nots. Most of the terrorists are able to exploit the people, exploit the gaps in the system, the social gaps in the system. So yes, there is need to retool the system. There is need to have functional education, the type of education that makes people have agency to understand that certain decisions are taken on their own without having to rely on, you know, the groupthink and, you know, the exploitation of their religion or their culture or their current economic situation. That is what the terrorists, you know, exploit most of the time. So for me, education is a veritable tool to restructure the mindset, to reset the mindset of people, you know, in the affected regions. When you have the right kind of education, the right type of exposure and intellection, you will not be railroaded into the antics of terrorists and insurgents, as the case may be.
Thanks, Mr. Ahmed, for that. Let's now take a short break before we continue our discussion on how the so-called U.S. war on terror has actually led to a 100,000% increase of terrorism in Africa over the last 2 decades.
U.S. increased terrorism in Africa.
listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back. This week we are focusing on an unprecedented upsurge of terrorism in Africa amid the presence of U.S. troops across the continent.
Bassoma Bazi, Minister of State of Burkina Faso, in an address to the UN General Assembly last year, stressed that his country, Mali and Niger, are dealing with a war imposed on them by imperialism under the pretext of terrorism.
Mali, Niger, and Burkina Faso are dealing with a war that was imposed upon them by imperialism under the pretext of terrorists, and these are sowing terror and destruction despite the UN Charter with principles of equality, justice on one hand, and on the other hand, international law, which has been often cited here at the UN. There is a massive chasm between in the treatment of these different issues.
Professor Abdul Wahab, what's your take on this statement by the minister from Burkina Faso, a country currently at the forefront of battling imperialism?
But that statement, I agree with him. You know, the Western imperialists are undermining the security of African nations. They are the ones who, in fact, assisting and supporting terrorism in Burkina Faso. When the military seize the power, then they can easily contain all those you know, militias who get a support from the Western imperialists, so that they can easily loot the African resources. So the question is, why, when the military came to power, Burkina Faso, Niger, Guinea, and Mali are more safe today than 2 years, 3 years ago? Because 2 or 3 years ago, all those guys were, you know, terror organizations, be it what they call Al-Qaeda or Boko Haram, are getting a support for the Western imperialists so that they can create a tension, conflict, you know, among the African societies. Africans, they must come together and defend themselves against the Western imperialists. The African society, they come together and fight against the terror groups who are getting support from the Western world. That's the only thing the African society, they can survive. Otherwise, the new colonialism is real, and they continue to root Africa. Because today, French, for instance, if French stop looting Africa, automatically French will become a third world country, as we speak right now. They will become a third world country. So in order to French become a strong nation, in order to be a superpower, they have to loot Africa. All Western cities or all Western, you know, countries, they build the blood of African society.
Now, apart from poverty, ignorance has been cited as a major reason that terrorist groups find recruiting grounds in Africa. Now, Professor Abdul Wahab Sheikh, do you think the root cause of violent extremism and terrorism in Africa can be addressed through proper education and training?
No question about that. Both education and training can, you know, can improve the livelihood of the African society, can improve the security and safety of the African continent. Mainly other factors, apart from the terrorism and violent terrorism, other factors which contribute the instability of Africa, including, among others, that's a political corruption, economic inequality, social fractures, and local grievances also contribute to the terrorism in Africa. So all those factors together, they in fact contribute the safety and security of the African society, apart from all those facts above are part and parcel of the insecurity in Africa. And the sooner they address the issue of the political corruption, the issue of the economic inequality, the issue of the social fractures, and also addressing the local grievances can easily improve the security of the African continent.
For decades, Africa has been teaming with foreign military personnel, with more than a dozen countries known to have deployments and bases on the continent. The U.S. and its allies, such as France, the U.K., Germany, Italy, and Belgium, have military presence on the continent. Despite this presence, insecurity is rampant across the continent.
A protester in Mali, speaking before French troops were ejected from the country, said that ever since they trusted France, a U.S. ally, to assist in combating terrorism, the situation in the country worsened.
I'd be so happy like at a party if France quit Mali today. Really, ever since we trusted them with our security, everything has become worse.
Clearly, these U.S.-led imperialist forces are the source of instability in Africa. Mr. Ahmad, what's your opinion on this?
Okay, so this is what I think of it. I always say that African problems require African solutions. Why are the foreign forces on the African soil in the first place? Africans will make, you know, gestures to them seeking for help and assistance. But you see, internally, what Africans should do is to close ranks, you know, is to look for alternative approach to defeating these monsters, because you cannot have investment, you cannot have hospitality, you cannot have your businesses and enterprise running smoothly if you have, you know, a miasma of insecurity, you know, cutting across the region. So beyond blaming and finger pointing at the U.S., we must internalize our solution. We must be able to say that within ourselves, we have identified the problem, and then we have homegrown solutions to fix the problem. Yes, it is easy to say the American forces should go. The American assistance, we do not need it. Western, you know, interference, go. However, we must find homegrown solutions, you know, within ourselves, close ranks, and ensure that we defeat, you know, the rising insecurity on the continent.
There is no doubt that U.S. forces are up to no good in Africa and are, in fact, there to take care of Washington's illegitimate economic and geopolitical interests. Now, many people in Africa are demanding that U.S. troops and other imperialist forces withdraw, as we have seen, and let African countries take care of their own security with the assistance of non-imperialist powers. Professor Abdulhab, you have the last word. What's your take on this?
The U.S. presence in Africa is not a good sign. It's not welcome at all in the continent. The sooner they depart from the continent, the better. For the last quarter century, the U.S. intervention in Africa is not good. A very good example in Libya, when they intervened in Libya, 2011, Libya was a stable state. Libya has functioning institutions. Libya has better life than today. But as we speak right now, where is Libya? Libya is gone. Again, the intervention of the Sahel states, specifically the French intervention, and together with American intervention in Mali, in Burkina Faso, in Niger, together with and Guinea, it's not good. That's why the African society, they start, you know, organizing themselves, they start, you know, against the Western interventions in Africa. They're realizing the military presence in USA in Africa is not adding up. It's not, you know, assisting the security and safety of the African nations. But it's a part and parcel of African problems. So the sooner they left Africa, the better. The sooner they depart Africa, the better. The sooner, in fact, you know, stop that kind of approach, which is undermining the safety and security of the continent, is better. They must come up with a new approach so that they can easily, you know, gain the hearts and minds of African society. Otherwise, the multipolar system is now real. And I don't think so now, right now, you know, U.S. intervention in Africa is highly welcome.
Well, there you have it. there is no doubt that U.S. military presence in Africa is a major factor in the upsurge of terrorism across the continent. And the sooner the U.S. forces leave Africa, the better. I'd like to thank our guest today, Professor Abdulwahab Sheikh Abdulsamad, the Chief Executive Officer of Afro-Asia Institute for Strategic Studies based in Nairobi, and Abdulatif Ahmad, a digital news editor. Well, and that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. From me, Mubarak Kenya, it's goodbye for now.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. This is Hossein Latifi and you're listening to your program for humanity from IRIB English Radio. In this program, we talk about different teachings from the Holy Quran about the human being and humanity. And we try to understand the position of human being in the overall theology of Islam. And in the previous episodes, we ended up talking about some of the ahadith that we have interpreting some of the verses of the Holy Quran about human intellect. We said that the role of intellect in the overall interpretation, the overall image that we take from the Holy Quran, image of man, we see that the role of intellect is a significant role, and that's why we need to understand what exactly this intellect is, and if it is anything that we normally call this person is very smart, for example, Quran also means that, or there's a specific sense of the word that has been used in the Holy Quran, or in the interpretations of the Holy Quran in the Ahadith of Ahlul Bayt and the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. So we said there is one beautiful Hadith from the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam that interprets intellect practically. Well, there are different theoretical discussions about how we can understand intellect, the relationship between intellect and emotions, and but one easy way to understand the nature of intellect is by seeing and locating the practical results and consequences and manifestations of a person who has intellect. So there's this beautiful hadith from the Prophet that says, if a person has perfected the intellect, then you have to check these 10 virtues in him or her. If he or she has these 10 virtues, then it shows that he has a perfect intellect. So one or two of them we covered previous episode. Now we're going to cover some of the rest. Another virtue is that a person who possesses intellect and he has rational understanding is that يَسْتَكْثَرُ قَلِيلَ الْخَيْرِ مِنْ غَيْرَهِ. Such a person, when somebody does a favor to him, he takes it as a big deal. He behaves in a way that shows that I appreciated your favor. I appreciate your help. يَسْتَكْثَرُ قَلِيلَ الْخَيْرِ. Even if it is small, then he thanks you, he shows gratitude to a level that as if it's a big deal. And we had this in the life of our ulama, for example, Imam Khomeini, may Allah be pleased with his soul. A person says towards the end of his life, when I brought just a glass of water for him, he started thanking me and showing gratitude, and I was somehow surprised. It was just a glass of water, but as if I had done something. This stems from the humility of a person. يَسْتَكْثَرُ قَلِيلَ الْخَيْرِ. And humility is a sign of perfect intellect. يَسْتَكْثَرُ قَلِيلَ الْخَيْرِ مِنْ غَيْرِ وَيَسْتَقِلُّ كَثِيرَ الْخَيْرِ مِنْ نَفْسِ. When he does a lot of good things, he makes a big favor to other people, help them greatly. He acts as if it's nothing. He acts as if it was his duty, it was something that... Again, we have this in the behavior of people who had been trained by Quran and Ahadith, and they have perfected their intellect in the school of Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. We're going to have a break and we come back to continue talking about the other virtues of a person who possesses intellect according to this beautiful hadith.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. This is Hussein Latifi, and you're listening to a program for humanity from IRIB English Radio. In the first segment, we covered two other virtues of a person who has perfect intellect, and now we should continue to know the rest of them. Another virtue of a person with perfect intellect is that he does not get tired from learning. وَلَا يَسْأَمْ مِنْ طَلَبِ الْعِلْمِ طُولَ عُمْرِهِ. A person with perfect intellect does not say, okay, now I'm graduated, it's finished, learning is finished. No, my brother, my sister, formal education is finished, if there is a finish line for that. Learning does not finish in your life. We always should be ready, should be accepting lessons. لَا يَسْأَمُ مِنْ طَلَبِ الْعِلْمِ طُولَ دَهْرِهِ. Throughout his lifetime, her lifetime, he doesn't get tired. Say, okay, I spent 20 years learning, then I don't want to learn. No, even in any vocation that you have, in any job you are, whatever career you have, there are always things to learn and be more perfect in what you do. So, a sign of a person with perfect intellect, according to the Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, is that such a person does not say, okay, now this is the finish line of learning. No. لا يسأل من طلب العلم طول دهره ولا يتبرم بطلاب الحوائج قبله. What does it mean? It means that if people need your help, if people come to you and ask you for favor, if you get tired, then it shows that the intellect is not perfect. And you may ask why. It is natural to get tired. But there is another hadith that explains this. There is a hadith, if I'm not mistaken, from Imam Hussein alayhi salam. He says that people request to you is a sign of God's mercy upon you. It shows that you have a ni'mah. It shows that you have a blessing. It shows that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has chosen you as a source of distributing His ni'mah toward His other servants, His other creation. And do not get tired from this situation. You know, if you do something that you like, you don't get tired. If you know the value of what you're doing, then you don't get tired. So Imam or the prophet tries to say, appreciate that position, the position of being in mediation in the ni'mah of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And this could happen in every sense. So when we say help and favor, most people, they think of like financial help. That's one instance, but it's not all. Sometimes it's about teaching someone something. It's about giving a tip to someone. It's about like supporting a person emotionally. So if you have that capacity to facilitate something for someone, to transfer some experience to someone, to help him does his or her job better, then appreciate that position and do not hesitate and do not feel tired. It is something you should enjoy it. So, and it shows a person with perfect intellect understand the value of such a thing and does not get tired of it. And then, yes, the rest of the hadith is very beautiful. I'm afraid if we continue, we cannot finish it in this episode. So we leave it for the next episode. Each of these phrases of the hadith, we can find traces of them in the verses of the Holy Quran. Why such a thing the Prophet has included in his hadith? And we realize that there is a Quranic teaching related to that. Inshallah, we follow it up in the next episode. Thank you very much for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
صلى الله على محمد صلى الله على النبي صلى الله على محمد وعلى آل النبي صلى الله على محمد صلى الله على النبي صلى الله على محمد وعلى آل النبي.
Farewell to the arms. The moment of farewell is one of the hardest moments for anyone. Whether it is saying farewell to your family, your home, your homeland, and the most significant of all, saying farewell to life. But for a fighter, the hardest one is to say farewell to their arms. Palestinian fighter and leader Yasser Arafat was a man who experienced each and every one of these farewells throughout his life. Now, he had turned into a comatose in a hospital bed in France before he experienced those farewells. His first painful farewell took place 50 years ago when he witnessed a series of events that changed his course of life. It was springtime in the small village of Deir Yassin. The inhabitants of the village did not want any war with the intruders. But some time later, the United Nations divided Palestine into two Arab and Jewish sectors and caused rifts instead of solving the differences.
The resolution of the Dac Committee for Palestine was adopted by 33 votes, 13 against, 10 abstentions.
After the UN resolution, the Palestinians possessed only 45% of their country in two disjointed segments, namely the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. The rest of the 55% was given to the minority Jews with a 500,000 population. By recognizing Israel as a so-called state, a war started. Now the Jews could expel the Palestinians out of their homes and replace them with the newly arrived Jewish immigrants. A year later, Israelis were the winners of the war. The 65,000 strong army that had come from seven Arab states to help the Palestinians could not do much. They were less than half the Israeli forces in numbers. On the other hand, the Israelis' newly purchased equipment, compared to the Palestinians' old and dilapidated equipment, made many people disappointed. The immigrant Jews, who had only purchased only 2% of Palestine's land from the British, were now occupying 70% of the land. The war claimed the lives of 25,000 people and left 700,000 Palestinians homeless and displaced. They migrated to neighboring countries. People lived cold and grim lives away from home. Their only hope was to return to their homes one day. Tensions were on the rise along the borders. The armed forces on the Jordanian and Syrian borders were on high alert. To support them, Gamal deployed 80,000 troops to the Sinai Desert and the Gaza Strip. The King of Jordan traveled to Cairo to sign a defense pact with Egypt. Syria and Iraq also joined the pact. The Middle East turned into a powder keg. A single spark could burn it in flames. Israel found itself surrounded from all sides, so it declares a state of emergency in all of its military bases. The commander of the Israeli army claimed that they're ready to enter any war the next day. All eyes are fixed on Gamal, so he'd start the war and end the Israeli entity before it could celebrate its 20th birthday. As the next step, he blocks all maritime crossings for Israel. 9 months later, the news of an explosion shocks everyone. A roadside blast targets a bus in Israeli-occupied territory, leading to the death of two Israelis. The Israeli army announces it will give an unforgettable lesson to the fighters who carried out this attack. A small group named Fatah claims responsibility for the operation. Their base was in a small town of Karameh, located near the Jordanian border. Gamal was worried a new war would create trouble for Arab states, so he asked the Fatah forces to immediately leave town. The Jordanian army made the same request, but Fatah members wanted to stay, even if it meant they had to give up their lives. Israel thought such a small group wouldn't be much of trouble for them, so they immediately sent 15,000 troops and 50 tanks to the village. The situation was dangerous for Israel. They were looking for a way to stop Arafat. It seemed impossible in a region where no country recognized Israel. At the same time, when tensions are rising in Lebanon over Arafat's presence, Fatah stepped up its activities. Some people in Lebanon did not want Arafat to use the land as a base for a war against Israel. All the opposition came from the Falangis movement, an organization that was created from the merger of some Christian Lebanese groups. Arafat did not want to destabilize Lebanon, but as the Christian paramilitary groups continued their provocations, some Fatah forces got into conflict with them. Once again, it was springtime and Palestinians hit hard luck. In a surprise attack on a bus, 27 Palestinians and Lebanese were killed. The Falangis claimed responsibility for the attack. The Lebanese government asked them to surrender those responsible, but they refused and took control of the area. No one expected such an attack, as the Falanges were just a political movement in Lebanon without much military power. A young man named Bachir Gemayel becomes commander of the armed militia of the Falanges. A month before the attack, they rapidly transformed into a disciplined and well-equipped military force at a time when they received multiple ships full of weapons and military equipment. Something was written on all of the equipment made in Israel. It meant that Israel has started a proxy war against Arafat. At the moment when Arafat needed foreign help more than ever, things did not go well. In Egypt, Gamal Abdel Nasser's advisor and deputy succeeded him, but he took a different path.
Let us agree that whatever happens between us, we should solve it together through, talks rather than going to war.
Egypt could retake the Sinai Desert after 20 years of Israeli occupation and then avoid conflict with Israel for the sake of establishing peace. But it wasn't the end of the story. Arafat asked different parties to help establish a ceasefire. In no time, the pressure piles up on Lebanon. A part of the Israeli army enters southern Lebanon with the help of the Falanges. Arafat decided to seek help from outside the Middle East to solve the problem. Arafat thought that the U.S. was the only country that could help him in this matter. Israel accepted the ceasefire at the request of Washington. A year has passed after the ceasefire, and during this period, Israel kept many Israeli forces on the border on standby. They wanted to speed up the war, so they appointed Ariel Sharon as the Minister of Military Affairs. Violence was the most prominent characteristic. In violation of the ceasefire deal, on the morning of the 3rd of June, 1983, Israeli forces prepare for all-out attack. 120,000 soldiers, backed up by 1,600 tanks, moved on Lebanon. Only in 2 days, the Israeli army reached the outskirts of Beirut without any major impediment. Even resistance within the cities could not slow down the Israeli advance. Arafat issued the order to retreat to all of his forces in order to buy time to reinforce. Now, the enemy was behind the gates of the city.
We are here, and we'll continue to be here, and we will defend this city, the first, it is very important, it is the first Arab capital which the Israeli are blockading. It is very important. You have to put in consideration what it means for the next generation. What have been done, you will pay its price.
Sharon's helicopter landed at Beirut's military airport so he could meet with the Falange leaders. Arafat's bases were bombarded at his orders. For him, destroying Arafat was the main goal. A missile directly hits his office. but Arafat had left the office a few moments earlier. He was cornered, he was completely surrounded, and had no way to escape. For 9 weeks, gray clouds covered the sky over Beirut, the defenseless city. Israel claimed that the targets of the attack were Fatah forces, but it is unarmed civilians who suffered the most. Arafat had to make a hard choice. To what extent did the people have to pay the price for the war? What had to be done in order to get out of this situation? And who could help him?
Good evening. President Reagan said today he's lost patience with the continuing bloodshed in Lebanon, and he all but demanded that it stop, telling reporters he intends to make that point quite firmly with Israeli officials.
American representatives enter Beirut to establish a ceasefire once again. The U.S. won Arafat's confidence and, more importantly, convinced him to take all Fatah forces out of Lebanon. In return, Arafat asked for the security of Palestinian refugee camps. In the end, the Falangists also reached their goal. After 7 years of war and bloodshed, their leader was to become the president of Lebanon. Fatah forces said farewell to Lebanon in several stages. After a few days, the final group prepared to leave. Arafat was the last person who was going to say farewell to Lebanon.
This is a part of this long march, yes, to our independent state, to our capital, Palestine, Jerusalem.
Arafat stepped into the path of the unknown with an unknown destination. It seemed that fate had driven a wedge between Arafat and Palestine.
Meanwhile, the number of dead and injured in yesterday's explosion, which killed President-elect Bashir Gemayel, has reportedly reached at least 60. No one yet has claimed responsibility for the bombing.
No one knew who carried out the explosion. But the Israelis and Falangists accused the Palestinians. Sharon claimed the Fatah forces had not completely left Palestine and were hiding in Palestinian camps. So he ordered a lockdown on them to find Fatah forces. He went to the Sabra and Shatila camps for the start. Fatah's base was located near the camps. The residents decided not to resist against Israelis and the Falangists. After 3 days, when the Israelis surround the camps, the Falangists were allowed to enter the camps and trigger a catastrophe. According to local sources, 3,000 people died in that massacre. Many of the bodies were beyond recognition. Many were buried in mass graves in order to hide this atrocity.
Thank you.
Naftali Ba'iri says he thought the Christian militia was sent in to drive out terrorists, not to kill civilians.
Do you think it was right to let them in there?
Maybe it was right to let them in, but nobody thought that that's what the result.
Arafat was shocked after he heard the news. He had trusted the U.S., but now faced what he feared most.
Protesting against these massacres and genocides against the Palestinians, which have been planned and organized by the Israelis, by the Israeli troops, and I'm sorry to say, and covered completely by the American administration.
5 months after the Sabra and Shatila massacre, a court hearing was held in Israel to shed light on the event. During the proceedings, it was revealed that the explosion was carried out by a Christian member of a Syrian organization and that the Palestinians had no involvement in the incident. Although Sharon was blamed for the negligence, he continued to remain in his post. And even in the next administration, only his ministry changes. When Arafat wanted to set up Fatah anew, he faced a crisis. He was confused for a few months, but he finally settles down in Tunisia, 3,000 kilometers away from Palestine. The long distance would make it very unlikely that war would be dragged to Tunisia. But at the same time, the distance had made continuing the struggle a daunting task for Fatah.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
The Washington Post reported that the United States has green-lighted the transfer of billions of dollars worth of bombs and fighter jets to the Zionist regime. According to the report, the new arms package includes more than 8,800 MK-84 2,000-pound bombs and 500 MK-82 500-pound bombs, according to Pentagon and Department of State officials. Some of the bombs approved have previously been associated with high casualty counts in the Gaza Strip. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, in recent days, the Biden administration approved a shipment of fighter jets and bombs worth billions of dollars to Israel, a new report shows. This decision came despite Washington's apprehensions regarding a possible military operation in southern Gaza's Rafah, which poses a significant risk to the lives of hundreds of thousands of Palestinian civilians. According to the Washington Post report, the latest arms shipments to Israel encompass over 1,800 MK-84 bombs, each weighing 2,000 pounds, and 500 MK-82 bombs, each weighing 500 pounds. The Post reported, citing U.S. officials who chose to remain anonymous, that the 2,000-pound bombs have previously been associated with significant casualties during Israel's military actions in Gaza. The MK-84 and MK-82 bombs, which were approved for transfer this week, had received congressional approval years earlier, though their delivery had not been completed until now. The 2,000-pound bombs, which can demolish city blocks and create craters wider than 40 feet, are rarely used anymore by Western militaries in densely populated locations due to the risk of civilian casualties, the Post reported. According to the newspaper, a State Department official said that fulfilling an authorization from one notification to Congress can result in dozens of individual foreign military sales cases across the decades-long life cycle of the congressional notification. The official told the Post, as a matter of practicality, major procurements, like Israel's F-35 program, for example, are often broken out into several cases over many years. Earlier this month, the Washington Post reported that the U.S. had approved more than 100 separate arms sales to Israel since October 7th and did so without having to notify Congress. Last week, Middle East Eye reported that the U.S. was planning to move ahead with several major arms transfers to the Zionist regime. Part of the package of arms transfers that the U.S. would notify to Congress is a new shipment of precision-guided munitions worth more than $1 billion. In addition to that sale, the U.S. planned to move ahead with a $2.5 billion sale of F-35 fighter jets. Josh Pohl, the former director of Congressional and Public Affairs for the State Department's Bureau of Political Military Affairs, said. The report from the Washington Post comes after a U.S. State Department official said recently that the famine likely exists in certain parts of northern Gaza, with other regions at risk of descending into starvation. This statement came a day following the world's highest court's directive for Israel to allow the entry of food aid into the area. A State Department official told Reuters, "While we can say with confidence that famine is a significant risk in the south and center, but not present in the north, it is both a risk and quite possibly is present in at least some areas." A State Department official said that the count of trucks delivering aid in southern and central Gaza had almost hit 200 daily, marking a rise from the previous month. However, an even greater number of trucks was required. Anadolu agency also reported U.S. President Joe Biden has secretly authorized billions of dollars in new bombs and fighter jets for the Zionist regime in recent days, according to a report published recently. The Zionist regime's war on Gaza continues to rage with widespread destruction, displacement, and death throughout the coastal enclave. Tel Aviv regime has vowed to